to remind Hobie of my efforts, the meetings, the marches I'd made with his parents. It only infuriated him.
Don't tell me about that! You think 'cause you went marching up and down the street asking people not to be so mean, I have to send you a fucking thank you note? What'd that ever do, man? That was nothing more than a walk in the fresh air!
Hobie kicked the coffee table, a miserable piece of cheap wood with a scarred veneer, so that it jumped against my knees. I know the world's fucked up, man, but it's changing. It's changed, for Christ's sake. 20 years from now, man, there isn't going to be a slum left in this country. Poor Negroes.
Blacks! Blacks, man!
It was Hobie's dad, Gurney, in his avuncular way, who taught me one day in his drugstore when I was 7 to say Negro rather than colored.
Right. Blacks. Blacks. Poor blacks are like immigrants who got off the boat in 1964. They're newly arrived. You think they won't jump into the melting pot, too? They'll stop speaking dialect. They'll...
Dialect? Man, that's our language. That's our culture. Shit. You know, I just can't talk to you about this.
Both Lucy and the dog cringed by the wall as Hobie strode from the room. In time, I found him on the back porch, a rickety wooden construction off the kitchen, where the floor was reinforced to hold a washer. He was ripping wet laundry out of the machine. He picked up 3 or 4 items, slinging them without aiming across the bright kitchen. A shirt stuck to the refrigerator, a sock hung on the clock. A pair of jeans hit the yellow wall with a moist thwack and, after a time, crawled down to the floor, leaving a glistening trail. He reared up in fury when he saw me again.
America is a nation conceived in original sin, and that sin is slavery!
Oh, stop it, I said. Stop trying to bend my mind with how bad the Negro people have had it. I get it, okay? And they aren't the only ones who have suffered.
You tell me who's had it worse!
Who? Oh, fuck you, Jackman! I wouldn't even be standing here!
Oh, that! That! Except the whole fucking white world got its little act together, man, and kicked Adolf Hitler's ass! Now, let's looky here over in the US of A, man! We got lynchings, and rapings, and burnings! We got KKKs, and white citizens' councils, and Orville Faubus! We got Bull Connor letting his hound dogs loose on black teenagers who just want to sit at a lunch counter! Have a sandwich, man! And did all them European leaders say, we got us another threat to civilization? Don't tell me, man. I've already heard it 1,000 times. That's different.
It is different. Even slavery isn't annihilation. From her corner, Lucy said it was all terrible and asked why it mattered which was worse. Neither of us was paying any attention.
Our slavery never ended, Hobie said. We will never be anything here but slaves or the children of slaves. Never! There is no forgetting!
Standing over the machine, he was virtually hyperventilating. You and I never remembered.
Bullshit!
He screamed. Hobie, you're tripping. Somehow, this was the worst thing I had said yet. He took fierce hold of my shirt. As I was trying to break away, I ended up getting butted hard by his forehead. My lip bled freely. Lucy brought me a cloth and ice, and I sat at the kitchen table, attending to myself. Hobie did not seem to notice. He came back in my direction, still screaming.
This is not a fucking trip! This is my fucking life!
Afterwards, replaying the conversation for Sonny, what shocked me, as much as Hobie's anger, was the instinctive speed with which I had seized my parents' experience as my own. I'd been indignant that Hobie, of all people, would forget the solemn moral claims of my heritage. Our relationship was never fully repaired. I knew Hobie better than to expect an apology, but he made no amends of any kind. His appearances at Doobie Hour became infrequent, and Lucy often arrived without him. We simply let time pass. The night of my birthday, March 12th, we tried it again. The 4 of us went out to a little Vietnamese restaurant Hobie had found in San Francisco. It was a hole in the wall on Van Ness, specializing in spring rolls and savory soups. Catholics, the owners had dolled up the little place for Mardi Gras with boughs of gilt leaves.
3 great cuisines, man, Hobie pronounced.
Chinese, Indian, French, and only one place they've met. We're bombing the finest fucking cooks in the world. Lucy wore sparkles in her hair for the occasion and had brought sequined pinwheels for each of us. Sonny gave me a copy of Abbey Road. We all drank Chinese beer. Hobie said it was the best high he'd had since he'd given up cocaine. I, and especially Sonny, were pleased by that news.
No lie, man, Hobie said. I'm totally checked out of this white-as-right bag.
Against the counsel of an inner voice, I asked what he meant.
The American thing, man. White men have been destroying people of color around the globe since the 16th century, taking their countries, killing them, or making them slaves. The war in Vietnam and the war on the U.S. plains, man, same damn thing.
You think it's just coincidental that those grunts in Nam call NLF territory Indian country? Think it's an accident we dropped the A-bomb on the yellow folks in Japan and not the whites in Germany?
And now, man, if one planet ain't enough, now you all gonna colonize the fucking moon.
These imperialist designs, Hobie said, were betrayed everywhere. Not merely in the gross manifestations, as in Vietnam, but in the seemingly innocuous items of daily life. Hobie was now convinced that refined sugar was the product of a ruthless oligopoly, the subjugators of Cuba and Hawaii, who had purified their product in order to addict children, while appealing to the basic racist subtext of American life by turning a brown commodity white. The same was true of cocaine.
White, said Hobie. Purity, propriety, cleanliness, and stature. This country's got white is right on the brain. Look at all those dudes going to work every day in white shirts, washing their hands in ivory soap. Think about it, man, he demanded. Think about it.
I studied him for quite some time, then told him he was mouthing Black Panther bullshit. He became incredibly provoked.
They are powerful black men, he shouted. Can't you dig? The Panthers are exactly what America has not wanted to see for 400 years, man. They are African males with their great big guns, not running, not hiding, saying, stick 'em up, motherfucker, I want what's mine.
You're fucked, I said. You're out of your gourd.
Man, Hobie told me, you can't even see me anymore. If I'm not just some cute Negro with a bunch of amusing things to say, you can't cope. Let's go, he told Lucy and stalked out.
I sat there an instant, unhappy with myself. I briefly looked to Sonny and Lucy for consolation, but I finally followed him out. On the crowded street of low, dun-colored buildings, Hobie stood on the walk, observing the streaming traffic mounting the hills of Van Ness. One of the Aboriginal fern bars was down on the corner. If I've been talking down to what you believe, then I'm really sorry, I told him. I've got my own thing right at the moment. But I get it, you know? I'm with you. I've always been with you.
You won't be there forever, man. Nobody white's gonna be there forever.
How's that?
This country's for you, man. It's for you.
It is, huh? That's why I have to run away from it?
Oh, you know. Time passes.
I couldn't believe it. I swore at him.
Okay, he said. I'm just saying how it is. I know you're against things right now, 'cause right now, they're gonna draft your ass.
Right, and you're a disinterested philosopher. You care about the oppression of people of color because you're a Negro, or black, whatever word it is this week.
But here it is, man. He pounded on his palm. 20 years from now, you'll be rich and fat and white, and I'll still be a Negro, or whatever it is that week.
And I'll be a fucking Canadian.
I understood all right. It was clear now. We had been through college. We had been through everything.
We had been children. We had played intense boy games. Football on cold afternoons. Wrestling, where he always was pinning me, sitting on my throat or bloodying my nose. We'd done junior high school who loves who, showed each other our pubic hair when it started to grow in. In high school, We'd made friends with Weird John Savio, who took us driving on the frontage road behind the highway in his mother's 3-speed Fairlane, which he ran at 110 miles per hour until the engine smoked. In college, we stayed up all night at least twice a week, drawing anyone we liked into our discussions about Occam's razor and various proofs for the existence of God, pondering the implication if it turned out that it was actually life on Earth that was really hell. We secretly knew we were the instigators of Easton's legendary freshman-sophomore water fight. We'd done heavy doses of cannabis and benzedrine, hoping to bend our minds about what Einstein had meant when he postulated that matter equaled time. We had been through everything. But we were not going to get through this.
I turned into a nag, worrying at Sunny. Come with. In my anxiety, she glimmered like a treasured object. I needed love's comfort, a body to hold, her to believe in. If she would come, I could go. Sunny continued to toy with the idea. I could tell she wanted to think of herself as valiant and right-thinking. But she took a job waiting tables at Robson's, a ham and egger on Campus Bull, and proceeded with her Peace Corps application. As time grew short, I insisted on personalizing things. The real issue, I told her again and again, was her commitment to me. She'd sit in the living room with her eyes closed, trying to endure my stupidity.
Seth, it's not how I feel about you that matters. I'm 22. If I was 32, if I was 42 and we were together, that would be one thing. But I want a life. My own life. I've never lied to you or led you on. Have I?
Sonny, I don't have any choices now.
I know, baby, and that's what makes it hard. Because what you're doing is important, and I support it. But thinking it through, I've spent hours, days. And look, how is this any different than if you were doing something else that was important? If you got into grad school somewhere or found a great job someplace? Suppose somebody offered you a job in Hollywood, writing movies. You'd go, right? Would you expect me to jump up and follow you?
Most of these discussions ended up as fights, bitter, accusatory. Without Hobie, I felt bereft, especially as my parents grew more frantic. One night, late in March, Sonny and I arrived home from a movie on campus to hear the second phone ringing in our apartment. It was my mother, no doubt hoping to twist my innards. She was beleaguering me, calling almost daily, either to implore me to come home to visit them or to see if magically I had divined some alternative to going to Canada. Oh, man, I was in no mood.
Call them back, Sonny suggested.
But I went to the phone. It was, instead, my father. There were few pleasantries. He got to the point.
Your mother has informed me that if you carry through with this plan to emigrate, she feels we have no choice but to follow you wherever you settle.
For quite some time, neither of us said anything further. It seemed preposterous. My parents never vacationed, never left Kendall County. Travel for them long before having lost any association with pleasure.
You're kidding. Deadly serious, he said.
She's crazy,
I finally managed.
We share an opinion,
my father replied. My mother, no doubt, was standing nearby, a hand poised dubiously near her mouth as she listened.
Have you tried to talk her out of this?
Repeatedly.
You're not coming, are you?
Me? My business, as you know, is here. At my age, the possibility of starting again in another city, let alone another country, is unthinkable.
Retirement was unmentionable. Without an income stream, my father would feel cut off from his vital source.
So? Your mother is determined.
She wouldn't go without you. Who would take care of her? My father did not answer at first.
I do not know precisely what she envisions,
Her son, of course, will be nearby. A sound of pure agony escaped me. Will she talk to me? He spoke to her momentarily, then informed me sternly,
No, there are no discussions. This is, you see, a decided matter. Punkt.
I was reeling, but crawling through me was the unlikely sensation of some sympathy for my father. He sounded collected, almost cheerfully so, but if she left, I knew he would sink into the clutches of his own peculiarities, afraid to venture beyond home, spooked by wrath and paranoia.
Sess, I hope this goes to illustrate.
My father could not continue. His voice shook with either rage or the humiliation of having to prevail upon me. But eventually he forced himself to finish.
I hope you will reconsider.
I waited quite some time, but told him at last what I always did. I had no choice.
This is not a plan, he cried. This is madness. You have no concept of what you are doing. How will you support yourself?
My father asked, always to him, the foremost question.
You cannot provide for yourself, let alone two people.
She's not coming, I said. You know she's not coming.
On the contrary, he said.
Can you not see what is happening?
Of course, gradually, I could. For more than 30 years, my mother had accepted my father's stiff personality, his 1,000 rules, as the price of his assurance he would safeguard her and me. Now, if he could not honor that compact, she considered herself the victim of a fraud. There was no use talking to her about the damage in her own life, because that was beside the point. She had long since agreed to an existence where she had ceased craving satisfaction in her own right, as if that only invited further terror. Her credo was simple. My child is my country, my duty, my life. She had survived solely so as not to abandon the future. No matter how ghastly it seemed, I knew she would follow me. While that reality crept over me, my father went on with his denunciations.
Do you know what it is to be a penniless immigrant with no means in a country that is not your own? I have some idea. War is not the only thing in life that is intensely unpleasant, Sess.
I will say to you what I have said to your mother. If you choose this course, if you cross this border, do not expect to receive aid from me.
I know better than that, Dad. Believe me.
You know better about everything, Sess.
I will never ask you for money. We had now reached the absolute core of what was between us. Underline, never. Do you hear me? He did not. He had already hung up. Someone said that money is the root of all evil. For my father, it was far more than that. Originally a professor of economics at the U, he eventually became a consultant to banks and brokerage houses, one of the first of the nation's money supply experts. As a result, I heard the theoretical justifications throughout my life. How money is the medium through which everybody competes for what they want. The more you want something, the more you'll pay. It's emotion made tangible, or comparable at least, a sort of river Ganges of life into which all desires somehow pour. A perfect theory, I suppose, ignoring things like how much everybody has to start with, or what the songwriter had in mind when he declared that the best things in life are free. But at least it recognizes that if you want money, you really want something else. What my father wanted, though, was never clear to me. His name was Bernhard, and thus he was frequently confused with Bernard Weissman, a Kendall County developer of vast wealth who owned the Morgan Towers in Dusable and several of the largest shopping malls in the country.
No, I am the poor Weissman, my father would always say, in a tone which, given his modulated manner, struck me as ridiculously abject.
I knew that he was doing well. This came from the comments of his business acquaintances whom we met on the street. but he made no admission of the fact and seemed to die inside any time he had to spend a dollar. In college, a group of us in the dorm used to conduct legendary cheap contests, exploring a strange common ground in which we matched competitively the miserliness of our parents. My main rivals were other ethnic sons, Slavs and Greeks, although there was one Yankee who was usually in the race. But I always won. My father took the cake. Our dormmates roared as I told the stories. How my father, rather than replace the evergreens in front of our simple hip-roofed bungalow, colored them with green spray paint after they died one particularly harsh winter. How my father would return merchandise to stores 2 or 3 years after purchase, when a button broke, a collar frayed, and haggle for some partial refund of the original price. How my father would keep important clients, bankers, waiting, so he could go buy a case of toilet tissue on sale. How my father, late at night, could be found refolding the brown lunch bags that I brought home from school, per his instructions, balled in my coat pocket. How my father put a timer on the bathroom light because, as a little boy, I often forgot to turn it out, with the result that I was frequently left terrified, still sitting on the can as the room went black. Yet, it wasn't the lack of possessions, but the atmosphere that mattered most. My father wasn't motivated by a spiritual disdain for material things. He felt none of the pleasure of people of little means, who enjoy the few things they can afford. There was a tight-fisted compulsive quality to my father's refusal to spend, a kind of death grip he held on the household, against which I always chafed, and which had led to our most wrenching prior dispute at Christmas time in 1963. In my household, there was never really a holiday season at any point in the year. In Vienna, my father had been raised as a free thinker. He identified himself as a Jew and was ever on alert for anti-Semitism, which he found pervasive. But even after his wartime experiences, perhaps because of them, he disdained all form of religious practice. That was not true of my mother, having lost everyone who mattered in the camps, having seen everything precious destroyed. She clung fervently to the customs, albeit in a fairly unobtrusive way, since she preferred no disputes with my father. She bought kosher meats, did not mix meat and dairy, and lit candles on Friday nights. On holidays, she celebrated in muted fashion, a polite Pesach Seder and a Yom Kippur fast. My father went to work. For her sake, I was given a religious education at Temple Beth Shalom, where professors from the U sent their kids. At Hanukkah, we lit the menorah, and my father and she gave gelt, not the foil-wrapped chocolate coins, but real money. In my father's eyes, this was a gift with meaning. The closest we came to any other form of seasonal celebration was driving down the snowy streets on Christmas Eve to admire the lighted decorations of our Gentile neighbors. My father, of course, approved of any form of entertainment which did not require spending money, and the lights always thrilled me. The brightness, the festivity, the whole season of free spending and open-handed generosity. At any rate, the year before I turned 16, I took the $10 bill my father had given me for Hanukkah and, on impulse, bought a 4-foot aluminum Christmas tree. I made the purchase at a local five and dime and had the tree set up on its green wood base before either of my parents saw it. In shock, my mother stood before the tree, which was mounted on a small end table in my bedroom, a bit like an altar, and remonstrated with me in each of the 4 languages she spoke. Consciously, I had persuaded myself that because he was not observant, my father would not mind the tree. Of course, he was in my room within instants of arriving home. He was a person of medium size. My height comes from my mother's people, and I think that neither of us could get used to the fact that I was already 2 or 3 inches taller than he was. He was one of those bald-headed men who lets the hair on one side grow long and pastes it across his scalp. He wore metal-framed glasses and a heavy woolen suit, 3 pieces. He rocked on his toes.
I see,
my father said in his heavy accent. With his talent for the most prosaic, he added,
This is how you spend the money we give to you.
I thought it was a gift.
I was lying on my bed reading.
A gift means a person buys what he likes.
No,
said my father, staring up at the Christmas tree. He shook his head ponderously.
No gifts for this.
The next day when I returned from school, the Christmas tree was gone. Neither of them ever offered an explanation, and my father never willingly gave me another dollar. The idea, I suppose, was that I was first required to make some amends, but that I refused to do. I know, in retrospect, how they saw what I'd done. Not simply a rejection, but an act of emotional vandalism. I ignored their pain, no doubt, but I took no pleasure in it. My concern was myself. I wanted to break out of the lightlessness, the dead air, the suffering and silence of my parents' home. I wanted to stake my claim to a life where every moment is not shrouded by the memory of the most terrible deeds, and to ask them, I suppose, to recognize that desire in me, to give me their blessing to be different from them in that fundamental respect. But this was not a destiny either of them had ever envisioned for me, and such permission, as it turned out, was never to be granted. After that, I had board and shelter in my parents' home. Otherwise, I provided for myself. I had a collection of odd jobs after school and over the summers. Hardware store clerk, busboy, fry cook. My mother was always tucking $20 in my pocket when my father was not around, but she did not dare confront him. In college, I financed my tuition with a federally subsidized loan. To embarrass my father, I went to his bank, where they knew how wealthy he was, and when I'd saved enough money for a car, I bought a Volkswagen, the Hitlermobile, knowing it would drive him wild. But in time, I realized that given impossible choices, I had lost anyway. I had indulged my father in his fundamental selfishness, and I never removed the restraint from their expectations. My mother never lifted her prayerful gaze from me, never stopped fussing over me or begging me in a million silent ways to redeem her life. I was never free. And the weight of all that fell over me again, now in the wake of my father's call. As Sonny watched, I replaced the phone. I sat first, then lay down fully on the rug. My hands were over my face.
Oh, kidnap me, I cried. Kidnap me, somebody. Kidnap me.
When I opened my eyes, Edgar was across the living room on the threshold of the open front door. Ironically, he held money, a few bills, rolled in his hand. He had come down to pay me for the week. Unspeaking, he watched me lying there in agony, his perfect, mad eyes unblinking. Intent.
What did you mean?
Edgar asked me the next night.
Kidnap you.
June and he had just returned from another long evening with the lawyers. A number of attorneys from the ACLU and Damon Law School had come forward to mount Edgar's defense, joining the old standbys, renowned lefties, who'd been defending the Panthers for years. I had the sense there were sharp divisions in the legal team over tactics, about whether the forthcoming hearing should be conducted to make a political statement or to save Edgar's job. Arriving home, the Edgars often appeared wrung out and at odds with each other. Scrutinizing me now, Edgar already looked exhausted, so dark beneath the eyes he might have been bruised. I'd often explain my differences with my parents to June, and I was in no mood to go over the subject now. But Edgar's look lingered. I sensed, as I often had, the special reprieve for Edgar in moving about in someone else's life.
So, if someone wanted to kidnap you, you'd go?
He asked.
I don't think they'd believe it.
I would think not,
June said. She was drinking bourbon and smoking. Sitting at the sofa's edge, she flicked ashes from the end of the cigarette more often than necessary, flipping her thumbnail against the filter. For whatever reason, practicing perhaps for the demeanor she'd affect in the hearing room, she'd taken on more of a subdued girlish appearance, a bit of the homespun country gal. Her hair was pulled back and secured with bright rings of yarn. She wore a little sundress, and the length of her smooth legs, without hose, glowed as she sat there. Leaning toward the ashtray, she jerked a bit on her hem in response to my inspection.
"They'd certainly have suspicions," she said.
Edgar held his jaw. A sign might as well have lit up on his chest reading, "I am scheming."
"What if there was ransom?" he asked. "Can your father afford it?"
"Afford it? Sure, he could probably afford a lot. But knowing my father, he wouldn't pay it." June laughed.
"Seth, you remind me of Edgar when you carry on about your father."
Edgar's father was a physician by training, but he made his living as a tobacco planter. If you could credit their descriptions, he was a man of ruthless temper, rigid, unforgiving, a hard-shell Christian more excited by the damnation of the wicked than the eternal grace of the saved. June and Edgar both referred to him in an act of academic derision as the mind of the South. For the moment, Edgar ignored June, struck by my prediction that my father would refuse any ransom request. He threw up his hands.
"Then you're free."
For an alarming split-brained instant, my liberty seemed to dwell in the tender field between Edgar's open palms. Then, the dreary misery of better-known reality reclaimed me. "Well, then he'd pay it to spite me." They both laughed again. Clapping her hands to her thighs, June said she was exhausted, and I headed down. Kidnapping. I laughed at the thought. Outside, as I neared the foot of the wooden stairwell, I heard Edgar speak my name. He'd come out to the landing above and stood in the intense beam of the floodlight.
"Would they call the FBI?
He asked quietly. "My parents?" I was startled he was still on the subject, but I shook my head. Given their history, my parents were terrified by encounters with the police. I had been in the car on more than one occasion when even a routine traffic stop had crashed my father into disorder and panic. His hands shook so fiercely he could not hand the copper his license, and it required half an hour at the curbside afterwards for him to regain his tenuous hold on the present. There was no prospect he or my mother would ever involve law enforcement. "No chance," I told Edgar. Standing a floor above me, he smiled. Amid the mounting anxieties of his own situation, this notion had become a diversion. He tapped a single index finger on his temple to show that he was going to keep it in mind. 4 days after I received my draft notice, Sunny told me she was moving out. It was the middle of April.
"It's no good, Seth," she said. "I have to do it. We're going to end up hating each other."
We were fighting all the time, bloody battles, in which I spoke of love and she of independence. "So you'll desert me now rather than later?" Sunny shivered to show she was exerting self-control. She had to make the point, she said. The point was never specified, but I understood. I couldn't have her. I was on my own. If she remained in the apartment, I'd keep hoping, keep putting off departure, instead of facing what was now inevitable.
"I have to find something else anyway," Sunny said. "I can't afford the rent here by myself."
"Where will you go?" She hitched a shoulder as if she hadn't thought about it much.
"I'll stay with Graham for a while. He's been trying to find someone to take a room."
This was a hammer blow, worse than mere desertion. He'd be in her bed within a week, I realized, if he hadn't been already. "Not what I think, right?"
"It isn't," she said.
"And
it's none of your business anyway."
We went at it again, of course. In the end, I helped her move. It was just as easy for me to load a few boxes every morning into the bug. I mailed her books to her aunts from the post office. The other items I dropped outside Graham's door as I was on my way to After Dark. I watched her disappear from the apartment in stages, like something melting. On the last morning, a Monday, we filled the bug and put on the portable rack to load the roof. Even so, a couple of boxes remained that I'd have to drop off later. Then I drove Sunny across the Bay Bridge, out of sunshine and into the fog. She hugged me on the street, although I refused to return any visible sign of affection. So, this is how it is, I thought. This is how it turns out. An epic moment in my own life, which I would always recount. How could it simply be happening, like any other moment in the ever-present is? There was only fog, carried like smoke on the ocean winds, and seagulls whose hoarse cry could be heard even though they were lost from sight. I noticed, marking him for life, a slender bearded fellow in bell-bottom trousers and a V-neck sweater moving down the steep hill in the usual heavy-footed way, his weight back to the heels. I had a sudden vision that I'd accost him on another street someday. I saw you when I said goodbye.
"Call me," she said. "All the time. Promise I'll see you before you go."
I took her hands from my face and studied them. Broad, sturdy hands sculpted with working grace. I figured I would leave for Canada by the end of the week. My draft board had obliged me in my last tactical move by transferring the site of my induction to Oakland. May 4th was the day, but there was no point in waiting now.
"People don't just walk out of each other's lives," I said. I wasn't sure if this was a protest or a response. "It's just another phase, baby. We're both going to survive. And nobody says it's forever."
Sunny often talked vaguely of getting together again in the future, after the Peace Corps, after I was able to come home. This notion, the hopes it raised, and my certainty that it was cruelly false, brought the unwanted impact of a sob halfway through my throat every time the subject came up.
"Thank you." "For what?"
For uttering enough intolerable bullshit, I had been about to say, that I actually had some desire to leave. But I had no control over myself, and the words emerged hollowly. By accident, I'd found the note I wanted to strike.
"Just thanks.
I love you. It's been a gas." I drove away. I had always known, I told myself. Some shockproof inner apparatus, a black box near the heart that invariably registered what was true, had never lost account of the fundamental facts. She did not care for me, not in the abandoned, soaring way I cared for her. I'd known, but trudged on anyway, dumb and hopeful, and now I was paying the price. Was there anything in life more painful than that inequality? A few blocks on, suffering miserably, I stopped the car across from the enormous rolling park near Mission Dolores. I knew I was back to where I'd started, to the unendurable agony of the young. I could not have put words to it then, but through time, I can make out that inner cry. Who will love me for myself? Whose love will let me know myself? I looked at the palm trees rising starkly above the median while I wept.
December 7th, 1995. Sunny. "The testimony is irrelevant," says Molto, standing before the bench. This guy, he has an unerring capacity to aggravate me. "Mr. Molto, you're the one who offered to bring in Tactical Officer Lubitsch. We had a discussion at Sidebar, and as I recall, you ended it by volunteering." "Judge, we've had time to think. There was no polygraph, so there's no discovery violation, and the testimony is irrelevant." "Mr. Molto, we've had sworn testimony that there was a polygraph, and if the witness is mistaken, I'd think the prosecution would be delighted to establish that fact. I turn to Hobie, who's beside Rudy. Mr. Tuttle, do you still want to explore this area? Mum to this point, Hobie offers nothing but a solemn nod. Call the witness. Judge! Enough, Mr. Malto. Tommy starts away, then wheels back. By the way, Judge, this business of not turning over scientific reports, he told us yesterday. Tommy uses a finger to indicate Hobie. He's too aggravated to speak his name. He told us he was going to test that money for blood or gunpowder and have a report this morning. Hobie cuts him short, avoiding a diversion. There's no gunpowder, there's no blood. I'll give them the money back right now. There's your answer, Mr. Malto. No gunpowder, no blood. Who's putting on Lubitsch? It's your motion, Mr. Tuttle. Tommy, with his dark, beat-up face, stares at me sulkily. He's been doing this 20 years, but he still can't roll with the punches. We'll call him Judge, says Tommy. This will take 1 second. He motions to Rudy. Fred rolls in, spoiling macho attitude. He's wearing his cowboy boots and a huge silver buckle on his jeans, an open-necked print shirt, and a tweed sport coat. Word is he was really something when he was younger, always looking for it on the street, with that imposing physique that strains his uniform and a challenging eye. Among the state defenders, the rep lingers that he's a hitter, a cop who'll smack an arrested defendant around. But Marietta, the unimpeachable source, says he's different since he's married. His wife, Angela, is another bodybuilder, whom he first encountered at one of those contests where they oil themselves up and pose. She was a champion, famous in those circles, and Lubitsch boasts about her now and then, in an openly admiring way I find endearing. They have one child. Like Marietta, I regard him as one of those people who has improved with age. Hey, Judge, he says, when he arrives before the bench, a bit too familiar. Do you swear to tell the truth? I answer. Fred's testified here before. Given the cultural limitations of police testimony, every defendant has received his Miranda rights, even though few do these days. Every cop has seen whatever his partner has observed. Fred strikes me as more or less a truth-teller, less freewheeling than some others. As he takes the stand, I notice he has his reports rolled up in one hand. Tommy waits for Lubitsch to settle himself, then Malto positions himself right before the bench. He goes for dramatic effect. A single question. Not even state your name. He lifts a reddened, nail-bitten hand. Officer Lubitsch, on September 12, 1995, or any other date, did you use a polygraph machine on Lavinia Campbell, either at Kendall County General Hospital or elsewhere? No, sir, he says. Tommy heads back to the prosecution table. Excuse the witness, he says over his shoulder. I smile at the gambit. This is, in all phases, a game which two must play. Mr. Tuttle, do you want to cross? Hobie sits in his chair for quite some time studying Lubitsch. His lips are rolled into his mouth, virtually lost in the gray-shot muff of beard. He's stumped. For the first time since these proceedings began, he does not rise to address a witness. Miss Campbell testified she had a polygraph. Did you know that, officer? I heard that. And she's lying? She isn't right, I know that much. She's lying. Objection, says Tommy from his seat. He's fussing with his pad, but he reels off a number of valid exceptions to Hobie's question. Asked and answered, calls for an improper opinion. Hobie stares at Lubitsch. Are you saying, officer, maybe the witness made a mistake? It might be. She misperceived something? Maybe. The courtroom is still. Hobie finally stands, taking the time to secure the front flap of his double-breasted suit jacket, a chalk stripe of soft gray wool. Did she think she was getting a polygraph? Molto objects to Lubitsch testifying to Lavinia's thoughts. Hobie rephrases. Did someone tell her they were going to give her a polygraph? Yes, sir. That could have happened. And who was they? Who told her she was going on the box? Lubitsch wiggles a bit in his swivel chair. I believe I did. I see. But you didn't actually do it? No. But she changed her story anyway. I mean, that's what happened, right? This girl was telling you one thing when you got there and something else when you left. Sometimes with these people, Fred stops. With an offender, sometimes. He wipes his mouth with both fingers. An experienced officer, sometimes I think I know pretty well when someone's giving me a line. Yes? We don't always want to take them down to the hall for the box. The lie box. Right. Here we couldn't. She's laying there with tubes coming out of everywhere. So what did you do, officer? We tell them we're giving them a box, only we don't. You created that impression? That's it. And how did you do that? We put something on her head. What? Something we borrowed from one of the nurses. What? That strap-like, you know, for the heart test. EKG? Right. And you put that around her head. So you could test what she was thinking? Lubitsch doesn't answer. His eyes roll up to Hobie and fix him with a dark look meant for the street. And was it just the pressure strap? Was that the entire apparatus? No, it had a piece of telephone cord attached. Attached to what? The thing on her head? And what else? A machine? Lubitsch looks hard at Hobie. Obviously, there's no point. A copying machine. A photocopying machine? Right. We borrowed that from the nurses, too. Then what did you do? Asked a question. And? Lubitsch shrugs. Then we pressed a button on the machine. For what? The answer. You get the answer from the machine? That's what we say. Is that what you said to Bug? Right. Hobie doesn't speak. Instead, he simply beckons for more with the back of his hand. See, we put a piece of paper in the machine before we start, okay? Then when we press the button, it comes out and we show it to her. Okay? And what was written on the piece of paper? She's lying. There is laughter, of course, a rippling chorus loudest from the jury box. So you had this young woman sitting there with a rubber strap on her head and a piece of telephone wire that was attached to a Xerox machine, and then you pressed a button, and it produced a piece of paper that said she's lying, and you showed that to her, right? Right. And she believed it? Because she was lying. Hobie looks to me, without even bothering to voice the objection. I strike Lubitsch's last answer, and Hobie expels a magnificent sigh of disgust as he walks back to the defense table, winding his head. Cops. Are we done? I ask. Hobie argues vociferously that Lavinia's testimony has to be suppressed. He calls the police deceptive and exploitative, as if the Supreme Court hadn't long ago decided to tolerate such conduct in the name of effective law enforcement. When Molto comes to the podium to respond, I greet Tommy with a dour look. He was running changes on me this morning. One of the iron rules of my courtroom, especially for the prosecutors, is that you pay the price when you mess with the judge. The PAs will run you over if you let them, and as a woman, I feel the need to be particularly firm. I'm frosty enough with Tommy to scare him. But I deny the motion in the end. No right of Niles was violated by what the police did to Lavinia. Bug, especially as a juvenile, would have a pretty strong argument that the statements she made to Lubitsch and Wells can't be used against her. In fact, now that I think about it, I see how Hobie persuaded Bug and her lawyer that she could ignore Molto's threats to throw out Bug's deal if she came off her prior statements. Given this monkey business, there's no way Tommy could risk re-prosecution, since Bug might walk completely. Hobie, the pro, does not miss a beat when I rule. In the alternative, Your Honor, he says, I'd like to make the officer's testimony part of my case, so I don't have to recall him. Relieved, Molto ventures no objection, but says in that case he'd like to ask a few more questions of his own. He stands at the prosecution table. Officer Lubitsch, after Ms. Campbell admitted she was lying, objection, he told her she was lying. Rephrase the question. After this mock polygraph, says Tommy, Ms. Campbell made a statement, correct? And is it fully set forth in your report? Lubitsch testifies that each of his reports is an accurate rendition of what Lavinia said. And returning to September 12 in the hospital, did you ever tell Ms. Campbell what Hardcore had previously told the police? I didn't know what Hardcore had said. Wasn't my case. Montague asked me to talk to Bug because I knew her, that's all. She told me a story. We did our lie box thing and she made her statement. You didn't tell her what Hardcore said? Nope. That's not my SOP. Tommy nods. He's just made up a great deal of ground. Sorting through it all, the critical issue in evaluating Bug's testimony is whether what she said to the cops in the first place was true. I could believe she told them what they wanted to hear, not so much because she seems easily cowed, even at 15 she isn't, but because she's clever enough to deal that way. But if Bug didn't know what Cor had said, there's only one way, realistically, her sworn statements to Lubitsch could match Hardcore's version of events, because that's what happened out on the street. At least, that's the way I add it up. Tommy does, too. He's gone back to his seat with an unbecoming little swagger, enjoying the fact that he's finally put Hobie in his place. In his chair, Hobie again is taking his time, his lips gummed over each other, staring at Lubitsch once more, puzzling something through. Officer, did you figure on testifying in this trial? He asks suddenly. Huh? Answers Lubitsch. Did you have it in mind as this trial was coming up that you'd end up as a witness? I don't know. I thought I might. You did. Hobie pushes through the mess of papers on the table. You weren't on the state's witness list. Lubitsch has an uncomfortable moment. His eyes briefly close, lizard-like. I saw Montague at Area 7 last week. He said the witness might be doing a spin, and if she did, I was going to have to come stand behind my paper. Just a warning. That's all. You didn't go review your reports at that point? No. I kind of live a day at a time, counsel. I would have thought she was too smart to flip, but you live and learn. That's meant as a jibe. He's clearly had an earful about how Hobie led the girl astray. And how did you find out you were going to have to come testify today? When I come on the job at 8 at roll call, I got a message, phone Montague. You didn't spend the day yesterday getting ready to testify? I'm off Wednesdays. I was putting up sheetrock, if you want to know. And when you reached Montague today, did he explain why you were going to be needed in court this morning? I don't know, says Lubitsch. Vamping. Sort of. Sort of, says Hobie. Well, at some point today, did someone, Molto, Montague, Mr. Singh, did one of them explain that Lavinia had testified that in persuading her to change her story, you'd told her what Hardcore had to say? I heard that. And you realized, didn't you, that it would help the state if you could testify that didn't happen? Nobody told me what to say. I understand, officer, but you've been around a lot of trials, haven't you? And you recognize the significance of your testimony that you didn't tell Bug, don't you? Lubitsch's eyes cheat just a trifle in my direction. I get the feeling that in somebody else's courtroom, Fred might try a line, a dodge. I have the picture generally. Now, officer, I want to hand you a copy of your report of September 12 marked as Defendant's Exhibit 1. And I'm going to ask you to read out loud the part where it says you didn't tell Lavinia Campbell what Hardcore had said. Lubitsch sits a minute, staring outward. He has that look again. Stop fucking with me. He bothers only with a bare glance at the report, which Hobie has laid on the rail of the witness box. He does not even touch it. It's not there. It's not there, says Hobie. So this is just something you remember? I said it's not my SOP. It's not your standard operating procedure to tell one witness what another witness has said, correct? Exactly. And that's why you say you didn't tell Bug. I say I didn't tell her that because I don't have any recollection that anything like that ever happened. That's why I say it. Okay, says Hobie. You don't have any recollection. He's moving around again. By now, I know it's a bad sign for the state when Hobie starts roaming. If I were the prosecutor preparing a witness for Cross, I'd tell him, watch out. If Tuttle starts moving, that means he has you on a roll. But Lubitsch doesn't know that and sits there, with his bulk and his attitude still thinking he's doing okay. And it's fair to say, isn't it, that you haven't had a lot of time to review the reports, or to get it firm in your mind exactly what went on in your interviews of young Miss Lavinia. I remember what happened, counsel. Hobie scratches his cheek. He is doing his best to remain mild, if not genial, in the face of Fred's hostility. Someone, Dubinsky probably, has told him Lubitsch is a regular here, something of a favorite of mine. Well, let's talk about your visit to Bug's hospital room on September 12. You say Montague asked you to go over there because you know her, correct? Not like we're pals, I arrested her twice. But you had a good relationship with her as a result? Good relationship? I don't know what that means. He's reared back, then subsides a bit, aware perhaps of how contrary he's becoming. I'm not trying to be cute, counsel, but you'd say we had a professional relationship. She knew I'd be professional with her. The first time when she got cracked, we sort of caught them in the act. I mean, when we, you know, tactical. When we get in the area, this operation of BSD, they're very good at rolling things up. But this time I saw some car tearing off and Bug and me had a little foot race. And I grabbed hold of her and I told her how it was, and she was cooperative. You told her how it was. Usually, when these kids are out selling small stuff, usually they'll keep it up in their mouth, the seams, so they can swallow it if the man comes on them. It's not enough to kill them, so they swallow. And I grabbed Bug and I told her if she tried to swallow, I'd have to choke her or pump her stomach, and for her just to spit it out, and she did. And you made friends, says Hobie. The delivery is droll, not quite disparaging, just enough to bring out the sad ridiculousness of the entire situation. He derives uproarious laughter from everyone, including me. Yet there is a homely truth here. There are probably 200 kids in T4 with whom Lubitsch and Wells have this kind of relationship. They know their mamas and cousins, their gang standing, maybe even in a remote way how they're doing in school. They treat them with some feeling. Fred has reason to be riled, and he treats Hobie to an acid look. I didn't ride her, okay? It was 1,000 feet of a housing project. I could have charged her as an adult. I didn't. We did it as a juvie beef. She did some home time. She got out.
You were fair.
I try to be, says Lubitsch, and hitches his massive neck.
And knowing you had been kind of fair to her in the past, Montague asked you to see her in the hospital.
That's the picture.
And you went with your partner.
Hobie starts through the reports. Wells.
You and Wells went, and you told her to roll to make a deal, didn't you?
That I remember.
And she told you what you took for a lie, namely that the shooting of Ms. Edgar was just a drive-by by a rival street gang.
That's what she said.
Are there drive-bys in that neighborhood?
Plenty.
But you were confident she was fibbing.
Lying was my impression.
Even though this girl was more or less in your debt, even though she'd been kind of cooperative with you before, you didn't believe her.
Lubitsch permits himself a slight wise guy smile. Grow up, he'd like to say.
I didn't. You remember why in particular?
Lubitsch looks to the ceiling.
Didn't hit me right.
Could it be, says Hobie, slowly, that Montague had already told you what Hardcore had said? Hobie stops to watch Fred. This is where he wins or loses. Lubitsch takes a breath and once more lets his eyes rise in reverie. He teeters an instant on the brink of denial, but now the events have begun to come back to me. That was the day Wells and he were in my chambers, calling the case a doozy. Fred said he was going to General. And he was gloating, because he knew all about it by then. He knew Hardcore had made Niall a suspect. Fred, I want to say, for Christ's sake, Fred. Instead, with little conscious intention, I clear my throat. His eyes hit mine. The pupils seem to enlarge in that half instant. He shrinks back in his seat, and it comes to him just as it has come to me. He almost nods, as if his obligation to tell the truth arises as a matter of personal allegiance.
That makes sense, he says. Do you remember that?
It rings a bell.
So you knew Hardcore had turned, and that you were going to this girl for corroboration, right?
Lubitsch takes a long time to make sure there aren't any snares before he agrees. Now, Hardcore's in the gang, in BSD. Hardcore's what they call top rank, correct?
So I understand.
The younger ones carry out his orders.
They sell his dope, yeah, he's important. What's the point?
Asks Lubitsch, clearly out of sorts, as many coppers become when they lose control of the situation. Hobie takes advantage to move a few steps closer.
Here's the point, officer. Do you know of witnesses in gang cases being threatened and, in fact, even hurt or killed?
I've heard of it.
Often?
Probably.
And in your experience, isn't that even more likely to occur when someone is offering testimony against a gang leader?
Lubitsch sees the point, then. He ponders what is coming next before saying simply,
Yes.
Now, officer, recognizing you came here on short notice, recognizing you didn't have much chance to look at your reports or to think about the events of September 12, recognizing that you ordinarily wouldn't tell a witness what another witness said, recognizing all of that, I ask you if it wouldn't have been a whole lot easier to get a homegirl to roll if she knew her shot caller had already done the same thing, and if she wasn't going to hurt him by talking.
Lubitsch's shoulders are sunk down, and he is stewing in all of it, getting caught by this defense lawyer and having to tell him the truth. Again, his eyes, almost involuntarily, move in my direction before he answers. That makes sense. And in order to convince her, you'd have had to reveal the details of what he had said. You'd want her to be sure you already knew the story she was going to tell you, right? I would have told her, I guess, some things. I'd have tried to hold back a little, you know, for a test. But I'd have to give her enough for her to know he'd turned over. And if she says one of the things you revealed to her was that Hardcore had accused Niall of engineering the shooting of his father, you can't, as you sit here today, you can't say that's wrong, can you? Lubitsch actually makes a face. He winces in reflection. He waits one more second, his full weight taken on both ponderous forearms which rest on the witness box. I can't completely remember, all right? That's the truth. She could be right, she could be wrong. She could be right? Asks Hobie. Lubitsch doesn't bother to respond. At the prosecution table, Molto is unconsciously probing his temple, staring vacantly at the oak rods that are mounted on the wall in front of him to baffle sound. Hobie has the center of the courtroom to himself. He smiles circumspectly at the witness, careful not to show Lubitsch up for telling the truth. But we all know he's at another high moment of lawyerly achievement. Bug's statements to the police now have to be regarded as no more than a loyal imitation of Hardcore. Core himself may prove a persuasive witness. There may be good